Greetings and felicitous solicitations, my excellent listeners. Welcome to this November 2011 Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening of Nummy Science, Jim Campanella. Let's get started. As I sit here wondering why exactly, again, I insanely take up my precious time shooting the breeze with you kind folks, I'm reminded that the life of an academic is more than what most people think, and even more so for a research scientist. I have had colleagues who harangue me for, quote, wasting my time, unquote, on a science podcast for the masses when I could be writing journal articles or another grant proposal or just doing laboratory work. In short, doing something, quote, unquote, useful. That attitude reminds me of a story that was told to me years ago by one of my old academic mentors who passed away recently. His name was Dr. Ed Garber. And he was a polymath geneticist at the University of Chicago, where I did some of my undergraduate and graduate work. And he was a fascinating guy. He did genetics work on everything from plants to fungi to bacteria. He was also born and raised in Manhattan's Lower East Side of the 1920s, and that alone made him an amazingly colorful fellow. Among other stories he told were some hair-raising ones about his exploits during World War II, serving as a bacteriologist in the Army's 1st Biological Warfare Division. Dr. Garber always reminded me a bit of Groucho Marx. Well, he looked a little bit like Groucho Marx, with the mustache of his older years on his TV show, You Bet Your Life, and he certainly had quite a dry sense of humor, a bit like Groucho as well. So what is this story to which I'm referring? Dr. Garber said that back in the 1950s, after he was first hired at the University of Chicago, his father visited campus from back east. Garber said that he proudly gave his working-class, blue-collar dad a tour of campus. For those of you who don't know, the University of Chicago campus has some of the most interesting architecture in the U.S. academic system, since it was modeled on Cambridge's architecture in the U.K. Even though it is not hundreds of years old, like Cambridge, the neo-Gothic architecture is really something to behold, especially in the flat Illinois landscape. If you are curious, go Google Harper Library as an example. Anyway, Garber told me that the longer he walked about with his father, the less impressed his dad looked, which was not what the younger Garber had expected. He finally asked his dad what the problem was, and his dad told him he didn't think much of the academic life. His father, who had been a laborer all his life, demanded to know what the point of all this effete learning was. I'm sure he did not use the word effete, by the way. One of the things Garber did say he said, though, was, "You guys don't do anything practical or make anything. What's the point?" Garber told me that he didn't have an immediate answer to that. He was a scientist, a teacher, and an academic, and was taken aback that anyone would say he didn't make anything. It was tantamount to saying that what you did was pointless and useless, and why even bother to do it? As Garber and his father continued to stroll the quads, they passed a group of giggling undergraduate girls. Dr. Garber had an upside and finally defended himself by pointing to the students and telling his dad that they were the product that his work produced. Garber told his dad he didn't make cars or loaves of bread, but he did help to shape the products of the university, which were its students. Garber's father was not exactly convinced and told him, in short, that he was full of it, but I guess that Dr. Garber felt a little more justified. I've never forgotten that story. Nowadays, as big universities gather new patents yearly and are now even acting as incubators for things like biotech businesses started by faculty members, Ed Garber's idea almost seems quaint and outdated. I suspect Garber Sr. would probably appreciate the modern university that has now arisen more than what he saw back in the 1950s, since they have now become more money-making operations than actually do try to produce real products and provide real services. But I'm a bit more old-fashioned, and I agree with Garber. Our most important job was education and is still education. And frankly, I look at my little podcast segment as an extension of the education process. I certainly learn more about science doing research for it, and I hope that I educate you as well. I'm not so impudent as to believe that my podcast listeners are my product, in Garber's terminology, but I really hope that what I ramble on about has some kind of impact on your day-to-day life. Okay, well, enough for the moment of that introspective mood. I suspect that the elder Garber would be even less impressed with me and my ramblings than he was with his son. I guess I'm in a kind of speculative mood today, sort of a meta-academic mood, to coin a phrase, because of an article that was published in the New York Times a couple of days ago by staff writer Christopher Drew. His specialty, according to his byline, is covering military technology. The title of the article was, quote, "Why Science Majors Change Their Minds Because It Is So Darn Hard," unquote. In essence, the story was examining why the U.S., which used to be the world leader in science, has had a massive decline in students who are graduating with science, technology, engineering, and math degrees. According to Drew, studies have found that roughly 40% of students planning engineering and science majors end up switching to other subjects or failing to get any degree. That increases to as much as 60% when pre-medical students are included, according to new data from UCLA. That's twice the combined attrition rate of all other majors. One reason so many fewer younglings are graduating with science degrees, at least according to the article, is that they come to love science in grade school and high school when there is no rigor placed upon them. They are shown physics demonstrations in the gym or brought to the local science museum or the zoo or, quote, build erector sets and drop eggs into water to test the first law of motion, unquote, as the article says. And there's nothing wrong with that. Let the younger kids learn about how cool science is. They should. They need to. It's important. They need to appreciate it. The problem is that the real world of science does not just let you play around to discover things. When these kids come up against the wall of calculus, physics, and chemistry in their first year of college, they suddenly discover that perhaps the world of science is not for them, and they drop out or change majors. And as far as I am concerned, that is fine. That is what we call selection in biology. The academic process selects for individuals who are suited to getting through to graduation. I personally worry more about students who refuse to change majors, even though every piece of evidence suggests that perhaps they would be better off in a less technically demanding field. They hang on for dear life and insist that they will get that science degree no matter what. The worst of these are usually the pre-med students who are unutterably not suited to being physicians. They will take the same course over and over several times, often failing it, but almost as often just withdrawing from it as they notice their grades getting worse during the semester. They are to be commended for not giving up, but at the same time, these desperate students have deluded themselves. I love this quote from the article. Quote, "We are losing an alarming proportion of our nation's science talent once the students get to college," unquote, says Mitchell J. Chang, an education professor at UCLA. Does Dr. Chang ever consider that those students simply should not be science majors? Who says they are talented? If they cannot do the math or physics or chemistry, then maybe they should be in some other major. And just having the ability does not mean they are emotionally suited to science either. Just because a kid grows up loving CSI or Grey's Anatomy does not mean they should be a forensic scientist or doctor. At least in the U.S., we have brainwashed an entire generation of children into thinking they can be anything they want to be. Put simply, they cannot. You can only be what your actual abilities allow you to be. So why isn't the U.S. the technological powerhouse it once was? Well, one possible reason is that the U.S. is not worse. We are simply losing ground to the developing world. In short, we're not lousier. They are just getting better. Another reason, it used to be 40 or 50 years ago in the U.S. that math and science were difficult subjects, and the grades given out reflected that. No one came out of high school with undue beliefs that they could succeed in science if they had not already demonstrated that they could. An academic colleague of mine who graduated from the Dutch school system says that educators in the U.S. are too soft. They are not allowed to give out enough lower failing grades, and so you get lots of American kids entering college with the mistaken belief that science is a lot easier than it actually is. A third reason, the U.S. has had a brain drain in the last decade. It used to be that we plucked the best minds from China, India, Korea, or even Europe after the last World War. There used to be few opportunities in those countries to excel in science and be recognized to make a living. Now, many students come to the U.S. from Asia or Europe, get their doctorates, or do their postdoctoral work, and then they just head back home to academic jobs there. India has a whole slew of new universities opening up, or industrial jobs that didn't exist even a few years ago. A fourth reason, The U.S. government is no longer putting the kind of money into basic science research that it once did. There are fewer grants from NIH and NSF, and the grants that are there are harder to obtain. Why go into a science field where you're going to have such a hard time doing your research, even if you're quite talented? A fifth reason. 40 years ago, students' attention was not pulled in 100 different directions. Teachers did not need to compete for their attention with cell phones, iPods, laptops, game consoles, Netflix, Facebooks, Flickr, and Twitter. I know the students have always been good at frittering away precious time. I was one. But now they can do it in the classroom while they're being lectured to. Someone pointed out to me that my reasoning is flawed because it is not just the U.S. that is plugged in. Many countries like South Korea or Japan are even more plugged into the net than we are. My answer to that is simply a shrug. I don't know. Perhaps it's a cultural thing. The U.S. has always been a place for those with an independent streak. Perhaps kids in other countries simply live in cultures where self-discipline is more respected. One of my former students, C.J. Urso, actually suggested a reason that Chinese may inherently be better in math than those who speak Western languages. He pointed me in the direction of a book by Malcolm Gladwell called Outliers, The Story of Success. The book examines why certain people succeed while others do not. This is the same fellow, by the way, who wrote the bestseller Blink. No, not the Doctor Who episode. Anyway, in a chapter called Rice Patties and Math Tests, Gladwell points out that Chinese is a language which naturally conforms to numbers, while English does not. Quote, "If you speak English, you have about a 50% chance of remembering a short list of numbers perfectly. If you're Chinese, though, you're almost certain to get it right every time. Why is that? Because as human beings, we store digits in a memory loop that runs for about 2 seconds. We most easily memorize whatever we can say or read within that 2-second span. And Chinese speakers get that list of numbers, 4, 8, 5, 3, 9, 7, 6, right almost every time because, unlike English, their language allows them to fit all those 7 numbers into 2 seconds. Unquote. Gladwell then references the mathematician Stanislaus Dehaene. As Dehaene explains, quote, "Chinese number words are remarkably brief. Most of them can be uttered in less than 1/4 of a second. For instance, 4 is si and 7 ki. Their English equivalents, 4 and 7, are longer. Pronouncing them takes 1/3 of a second. The memory gap between English and Chinese apparently is entirely due to this difference in length. In languages as diverse as Welsh, Arabic, Chinese, English, and Hebrew, there is a reproducible correlation between the time required to pronounce numbers in a given language and the memory span of its speakers. In this domain, the prize for efficacy goes to the Cantonese dialect of Chinese, whose brevity grants residents of Hong Kong a rocketing memory span of about 10 digits. Unquote. Dehaene points out this is even worse with numbers above 10, which are named very irregularly in English, 11, 12, etc. In China, Japan, and Korea, they have a logical counting system. 11 is 10-1, 12, 10-2, 24 is 2-10-4, and so on. The problem with English is that Asian children learn to count much faster than anyone who speaks English. A 4-year-old Chinese child can count on average to 40. American children at that age can count only to 15, and most don't reach 40 until they're 5. Ahem, not to brag or anything, but my 3-year-old can count to 30, and my 5-year-old to 100. But my kids aren't average. On average, by age 5, American children are already a year behind their Asian counterparts in the most fundamental of math skills. Gladwell suggests that it only gets worse from there. Addition is a natural language process in Chinese because of the way the numbers are spoken. You can easily add 3-10-7, which is 37, and 2-10-2, which is 22, because the necessary equation is right there. As Gladwell says, it's embedded in the sentence. No number translation, like in English, is necessary. The answer is 5-10-9. It's the same with fractions. They just make more sense in Chinese. So it may be that we are naturally at a disadvantage here and may never catch up if we continue to depend on our English. This is not a good thing to contemplate. One final reason why the U.S. is falling behind in science is that science is no longer as lucrative from a financial standpoint as it once was. Here's one example. It used to be that the U.S. had most of the brightest minds in the country going to medical school. This was before the 1990s. You could be young and bright and work hard and eventually make a huge amount of money. And you can still do that if you can get through the rigors of the process. But in the 1990s, things changed. Smart kids who would have gone to medical school at one time and who were motivated by the power and money started to go into business instead. And they realized that for a lot less work, they could make a ton of money. And by the way, many economists are now blaming those smart guys in the 1990s who went into the business world for the worldwide financial crisis that we now find ourselves in. Lucky us. It's still unclear whether that trend is still continuing. At my school, the College of Business is only second in the number of majors to biology majors, which suggests that they may be running neck and neck now. Well, I have no doubts that there are more reasons why the U.S. is losing out technologically to India and China now, but you wonder after a while whether it even matters. If other countries are doing well, well, then good on them. Presumably they have worked hard to get to that point. People in the U.S. do not seem to be working so hard or are so worried about it as they once were. And I'm sure that the U.S. will do better when it needs to do better or when it is forced to do better. And if not, que sera, sera, as the old saying goes. At this point, you guys are either fast-forwarding or wondering whether I will ever get to a real science story. If you stuck with me through my little rant, yes. Here are a couple of more hard science stories. The first is an update on cell phone use in cancer. You may remember maybe a year back when I reported on studies that suggested that heavy use of cell phones may cause cancer. Well, actually the study suggested any use of cell phones may cause cancer. Well, that possibility seems way less likely now than it did even a short time ago. Several different studies have been performed that suggest there is no greater chance of getting brain cancer by using cell phones. The first study is a large European one that examined adults and cancer risks of cell phone usage. Dr. Patricia Frey of the Danish Cancer Society's Institute of Cancer Epidemiology was lead author of a study that was published last month in the British Medical Journal. To put it very simply, Frey's study examined 358,000 Danish cell phone users over the last 17 years. This is so far the largest study of its kind. She found that subscribers of 13 years or more faced the same cancer risk as non-subscribers. In other words, using the cell phone did not make them statistically more prone to any higher cancer levels. As if she couldn't leave well enough alone, by the way, Frey pointed out in the article that even though a majority of studies, by the way, there are at least 10 studies now, show no link between cell phone use and cancer, one exception is a 2010 study that found a slight, statistically insignificant increase in risk in a rare form of brain cancer called glioma among cell phone users. So even though she is saying that cell phones seem to be safe, Dr. Frey is insisting not to give up hope that they may be dangerous. There is still that small chance. And people say that I'm a pessimist. Anyway, the second study is from a Dr. Iden from the Swiss Tropical and Public Health Institute and entitled, quote, Mobile Phone Use and Brain Tumors in Children and Adolescents, a Multicenter Case Control Study, unquote. The paper was published last month in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. This work was the first study specifically designed to address cell phone use among children and adolescents diagnosed with brain tumors. They conducted an international case-control study of children and adolescents between the ages of 7 and 19 years in Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Switzerland. Children who were diagnosed in 2004-2008 with brain tumors were identified with various clinics and registry records, along with controls, and were randomly selected from the general population. Cell phone use was estimated based on face-to-face interviews with a parent present and from cell phone subscriber records that were made available. The results were consistent with virtually all the studies of adults exposed to radio frequency waves, and no convincing evidence was found that children who use cell phones are at a higher risk of developing a brain tumor than children who do not regularly use cell phones. There were no consistent exposure-response relationships for any of the metrics evaluated, whether by time since first cell phone use, cumulative duration of calls, cumulative number of calls, or the location of the brain tumor with respect to the ear, that is the side of the head, most often used during calls. As with the adult studies, negative data is always a problem. It's impossible to prove a non-effect, and all these results will be debated as to whether and at what level additional research funds should be spent in assessing health effects associated with non-ionizing radiation, especially in this time of limited resources, which I spoke of earlier. Ongoing research includes a large-scale study of rodents exposed to cell phone frequencies that is now being conducted by the National Toxicology Program. Another prospective study has been proposed that is recruiting 250,000 cell phone users in 5 European countries. And a case-control study of 2,000 young people is being done who were diagnosed with brain tumors between the ages of 10 and 24 years and an equal number of control subjects. This is from 13 different countries. Okay, the last story of the night is directly from the latest Global Flu Watch, which is a report by the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. Researchers have come across a new nasty confluence of viral problems in Asia in the last few months. For those of you who have seen the movie Contagion, it's really not that bad yet, so calm down. The November issue of the Journal of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene reports finding an influenza-like illness in Cambodia, where individuals have become infected with a seasonal influenza and also at the same time a pandemic strain of influenza. This is a reminder of the ongoing risk of distinct flu viruses combining in human hosts to produce a more lethal strain. A pandemic strain, by the way, is a type of flu against which people have little or no natural immunity. While the infected individuals recovered and the two strains did not recombine into a new, nastier, and different virus, experts say co-infections in Southeast Asia deserve particularly close scrutiny given the ongoing transmission of the deadly avian influenza virus H5N1 and the circulation of the pandemic virus H1N1 that first emerged in 2009. This report comes as flu season gets underway in the United States and Europe, and while Cambodia and other tropical parts of Asia are reporting continued flu activity. The ASTMH reports that as of October 10, 2011, the World Health Organization has tallied 566 known human infections with H5N1 and 332 deaths for a fatality rate of over 60%. In Cambodia, 16 of 18 infected individuals have died, with the most recent case reported in August. Thus far, the virus has shown a very limited ability to pass from human to human. Almost all the infections have been traced to contact with sick poultry and other diseased birds. But in the scientific community, fears remain that under the right conditions, avian flu could acquire far greater human virulence through a co-mingling, or reassortment if you want to call it that, with a human viral strain. Researchers are keenly interested in identifying any co-infections because, regardless of their immediate risk, there is an urgent need to learn more about the human role in the, quote, genetic reshuffling, unquote, that allows different influenza strains to interact and create a pandemic strain. For example, researchers probing the dual infections in New Zealand found that the H1N1 pandemic flu strain was co-inhabiting with a strain that was resistant to the antiviral Tamiflu. Such co-infections, they said, quote, raise the potential of a Tamiflu-resistant pandemic strain, unquote. The worst-case scenario, says the report, is one in which a co-infection with avian flu and a human strain results in a highly lethal virus that easily jumps from person to person, such as in the movie Contagion. As the study on the Cambodian co-infection notes, the prevalence of H5N1 strain in poultry in many areas of Southeast Asia provides increased opportunity for human exposure and adaptation of a lethal virus suitable for sustained human transmission. Several pandemic flu strains, including the 2009 H1N1 outbreak, have displayed a mix of genetic material from human and animal influenza. To give you an example, H1N1 virus isolated in Southern California in 2009 contained genetic elements from at least four different sources, including North American swine flu, North American avian flu, human influenza viruses, and Eurasian swine influenza viruses. Similarly, the flu pandemics of 1957 and 1958 have both been traced to a reassortment between human and avian viruses. If director Steven Soderbergh is even close to being correct about the next big pandemic coming down the pike, it may be a very long winter coming up for flu sufferers. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care, continue to use your cell phone warily, and stay away from sick chickens. Until next time, happy Thanksgiving to U.S. listeners, and this is Jim Campanella. Good night.